Really fantastic to see you all here. My name is Nick Wagger. I'm the Chief Executive of the ACP, and you are very, very welcome to what we're hoping will be the first in a intermittent series that we're calling Key Debates about the future direction and development of the profession of child psychotherapy. And tonight we're kicking off with what's very much a key debate, is how we interact with, respond to, participate, contribute to research agenda, questions about evidence and effectiveness. So we've got a fantastic panel going to talk to you, and there's going to be plenty of time for you to make your points or to ask questions. And we've also, experimentally, we've got some people, some members who are joining us online. So hello to them. As you said, hello to the people who are joining us on Zoom, and we will try and bring them in some point if that proves to be possible, and we're hoping that we'll also be able to record it so it will be available to members after today. So that's it from me for introductions. I'm going to hand you over to the chair for this evening, who is Peter Wilson. So I'll hand over to you, Peter. Thank you.
Well, welcome. Thank you for drawing yourself away from your TV sets to be here. This is the most important issue that we are here to discuss. And hello to you. I'm Peter Wilson, and I qualified as a child psychotherapist in 1971. I know you can't believe that. It's gone wrong somewhere. Anyway, I've been around for a very long time, frankly, in child guidance units in the good old days, CAMs, therapeutic communities, adolescent centres, and I founded and ran Young Minds. And I've worked a place to be for a long time. So, been around for a long time. And I have been really excited, actually, by Nick's initiatives, really, now that he's chief executive of the association, because he really does seem to be putting his finger on the key issues, doing some terrific work, I think, in making the views of our members clear to government, governments, ministers, and so on. And I think it's his idea that we do something like this to consider the whole issue of evidence for our work, and really how far can we influence, persuade, excite commissioners to employ our services. And now clearly they depend so much on evidence-based practice, and the conventional, the accepted evidence-based practice, yeah, points to the sort of CBT, solution focus, and so on. And it rather leaves our profession in the dark. And I have been really quite angered by that, I have to say. And I've written a chapter in the book, Critical Issues in Child and Adolescent Mental Health. And the title of my chapter was What Evidence Works for Whom. There's that series of books, What Therapy Works for Whom, What Evidence Works for Whom. Because I'm very concerned that we are being undersold. In that chapter, I wrote a lot about how I was very offended by something that came out of the evidence-based unit of the Anna Freud Clinic. They were doing something very useful, so it seemed to me, to inform young people about what therapies they should be interested in. But there was a major task, and they star-rated various therapies, which I thought was rather crass. And when you add up all the stars, medical treatments was the top, cognitive behavior was second, behavior therapy, family therapy was fourth. There was hardly anything about psychoanalytic psychotherapy, absolutely nothing about counseling. But this went out to inform young people about therapists, and I thought it was really quite outrageous for them to see. So I've been angered, and I've been moved to look more critically at this issue than I think has been the case in the past. I think there is a prevailing scientific hegemony, if you like. The random controlled studies are the gold standards, is the gold standard. And yet they're very difficult to set up, they're very expensive, And they don't seem to really point very clearly towards the kind of work that we do. We know that CBT is recommended for mild to moderate problems. But I think what is driving everybody crazy these days are the severe problems. And I don't think CBT points to any effectiveness there at all. We have yet to persuade others that we have personal relevance to those kinds. So I give this introduction with a little touch of anger and energy, because I think we are in a very important profession. I think we stand out really as being, having an approach which is fundamentally psychoanalytic, which is quite unique, because the other professions do not have that. They may include it, but they don't really base their work and their identity on psychoanalytic thinking and working through. And so I think, you know, the public are being deprived of support for the kind of work that we do, and a lot of very disturbed kids are just simply not being treated. So I'm very impressed that we are having this evening, because I think it concerns our profession. Maybe we need to look more critically at what is our profession, what is going on, what are we doing in the clinics. Things have changed enormously in my time. Things are much easier for me in my days. Actually, it's much less control, much less surveillance, much less bureaucracy. I had an easier time, unquestionably, when I was there. But it's now become very rigorously managed. And I just wonder what the job is like. Is that it's just a different job, I believe, from what I did when I worked in child hospitals and ran the places that I ran. So this is how I see this evening. We're looking critically at the evidence. What next for research into the evidence of effectiveness in psychoanalytic child psychotherapy? What next for research? And so we have four people who are going to, as it were, give their thoughts about this kind of issue. Ruth Schmidt, who I've known for a very, very long time, is going to be the main speaker. And something like 15 minutes or so, and she will give her views on this subject. And then we have three panelists who each in turn will give about 10 minutes of their views on all of this. So the time, we want this to be as informal as possible, but in order to give it some structure, we thought it'd be good if we just hear in sequence four views. So it will help us get our minds around it and then open it up for general discussion and see how it goes. There's been a debate which Nick has been leading on whether or not we should organize a big conference around this theme or whether we should do something like this. And I think the general consensus was, let's start small, let's see what emerges from it, let's see whether or not there is enough substance to take this to a larger audience. So the idea is that we'll ask Ruth to speak for 15 minutes. We'll then ask Janice, Elizabeth and Nick to speak for 10 minutes in turn, to ask them for another 10 minutes or so to debate amongst themselves what they've been listening to with each other, and then open it up to the whole group. That's the general plot, yeah? I'm going to ask all of them, everybody, to introduce themselves rather than me have an inadequate summary, to ask each of them where they've come from, why this subject matters to them, and what they think they would like to say, yeah? So I'll ask each of you to do that. Yeah. So I think we are ready to begin. And we'll keep you in mind over there, which easily will come out of my mind unless I make sure I remember who you are. And I'm waving gormlessly into a television screen at the moment. hoping that you are there. Okay. All right. Are we comfortable? Sitting comfortably? Let us then begin, as they say. Ruth.
Good. And do you want me to stand up?
What would you want this most? It'd be probably a good idea.
Just wondering if I can. I hope this is going to work. I think people will have known a little bit about my background. I'm a child psychotherapist, I'm a clinical psychologist. I've worked for over 20 years in the National Health Service. I started out life actually as a psychiatric social worker. And I've worked with a number of different populations. But I think just very briefly, I'm enormously committed to what I would call taking specialized knowledge out of the community, out of the clinic setting into the community. And I'm very passionately committed to the idea of prevention. And what I want to talk about today is really not just research and evidence-based research. I really would like to talk about the way forward for our profession, the child psychotherapy. We've been going for over half a century, and I think it's timely to really begin to look at what is involved in that. Just before I do that, I'd really like to thank Nick very, very much for setting all of this up, and Leanne. And I'd also particularly like to thank Heather Stewart, because she actually initiated a lot of this, because when I wrote my piece for the Bulletin, I rather thought it would disappear into a black hole and people would say, well, that's Ruth banging on about the stuff that she bangs on about. But so I was very pleased when Heather emailed me actually when I was in Tasmania at the beginning of the year in a rather obscure little place, struggling to get Wi-Fi. And she said it was an important article and she hoped that people might want to read it. So I was terribly touched, impressed, and I must say I'm amazed to be here. So I'm very, very excited. Now, what I have to say may rattle people a lot or a little, I'm not sure, but I feel because I feel what we're struggling with is so important, and the children and adolescents and young people and families that we try and work with are so important that I'm going to throw out a number of thoughts, ideas, and opinions with which you may agree, disagree, or feel outraged by. But I will start by saying that that I think child psychotherapy is in transition in a major sense. We're working within a changing emotional, social, and economic climate that cannot be denied. We have got to adapt to that. Which doesn't mean that we should adapt in terms of operating with respect to the lowest common denominator, the sort of things that Peter, you've been talking about. But I believe that the idea of the research is terribly important. It's vital that we are engaged in research, but the research and the research agenda must follow from an agreement about a core conceptual framework for the profession as a whole. And I feel that we, to some extent, have lost our way a bit. I think there are different opinions about what actually child psychotherapy is supposed to be doing, to whom and why and what. So in that sense, I think the research and research findings can't really direct the profession. Now, what I've done is I've set up what I call a sort of mapping the dilemmas as I see it. I think the first thing is that there is a fear-driven agenda that leads to an espoused concern to prove the efficacy of a treatment method to satisfy political agendas. And I think once a profession gets caught up in that, it loses sight of what its core essence really is all about. The other thing, and I think this is where people may really disagree, but I begin to feel that this is a very core issue, is that child psychotherapy is identified primarily as a single treatment mode profession. And that is what has directed a lot of the research, as far as I understand it. And I see that as a problem because I feel it's too limited and it's too narrow. And then I think there's the focus on children and adolescents, often to the exclusion of parents or parents perceived as an afterthought. And I have to say that it simply isn't feasible, that the child is in the parent is in the child. The basic element of therapeutic work, the sort of the core group that we need to work with, if you like, the core system, has got to be the child, the adolescent, the young person, and their parents. And we cannot split off the child and say that the parents are the responsibility of another profession, because that leads us into really basically nowhere. I think there is an ideological battle that has been raging for a long time for what I call the heart of child psychotherapy. What is the heart of child psychotherapy? And the notion that it is about individual psychoanalytic long-term work, and that it is precisely the fact that it is psychoanalytic and particularly long-term that sets us apart from other professions. And I've been at pains at various times in various pieces that I've written, where I believe that the idea that a profession defines itself in terms of how long it spends with someone is not useful and helpful. A surgeon doesn't say, well, I'm a brilliant surgeon because I've just conducted a three-hour operation. They will say they're a brilliant surgeon because they've conducted a brief piece of surgery with some brilliant way of, in fact, helping people. So I think the other, what follows from the idea of the long term, and I will talk about this in a little bit more detail, is the notion that because it is long term, we are then able to deal with some of the most disturbed children and adolescents in the community. And I want to talk about that as well, because I feel that that becomes a kind of a trap. And I will explain a little bit about why it's a trap. And then the other element is that I think there is a highly trained, enormously talented membership. People who come into the profession with other, who have already had other professions, who are enormously trained, fantastic membership, high-powered people, high-powered academics, high-powered professionals who come into child psychotherapy, whose work on the ground, I think, is substantially wider ranging than the espoused focus on long-term psychoanalytic therapy. But the other thing that's very worrying, it certainly was the case when I trained, and I think Peter and I have often talked a little bit about this, that it's a bit like going into a monastery where you give up your previous life and you take on the psychoanalytic dogma, and the, who you were before and what you did before doesn't count as much because you're going to move into this new transitional, you're transitioning into another state. And I think it's absolutely extraordinary because here are people with amazing experience that they bring into the profession, typically absolutely underused. So I think that is that's the series of dilemmas. Then the question is, what is the outcome of these dilemmas? So I think the outcome is that we are in danger of following a research focus which is concerned primarily with the identification of psychopathology in children and adolescents, that excludes the family and social context and strives to emulate an already, what I think is an outdated medical model of understanding. And I would say, perhaps in a group of friends, if I may say this, that I know Professor Goodyear was the head person in the major research that was carried out. And I happened to be at a conference in South Africa where he was gave a keynote address. And I felt that his denigration of anything to do with talking therapies was really quite extreme. And I know that perhaps he may have changed his views. But I was so, and this was in a large auditorium, and I felt absolutely bound to have to speak up and grab the microphone and say that there really, well, there had to be other ways of thinking about it. So I feel we've got to be very concerned about where and who we ally ourselves with. And I think there is a danger that this type of research leads to an increasingly fragmented, hollowed out vision of child and adolescent mental health, again, based as it is on the atomizing of single strands of behavior, you know, what is going to work for this specific form of psychopathology. I think it could be an opportunity for research, but it can't be the exclusive total opportunity for research. The other problem is that when we identify child psychotherapy solely as a treatment mode profession, then what happens if you have the single treatment mode, which is the focus on psychoanalytic psychotherapy, then the research has to be harnessed in order to prove its efficacy. And what one in the end ends up with is in some curious way, a denial of what we were set up to do in the first instance. Now, I tend to prefer the term psychodynamic to psychoanalytic, I have to say, because it encompasses a number of different elements, which is where I think child psychotherapy has to be, because we really, what we need to focus on is, of course, how the child's problem speaks the family. And so that needs to be an essential element. Now, another a problem about an ideological position of what is the heart of child psychotherapy. It's got to be long-term psychoanalytic psychotherapy, is that it's opened the field to absolute colonization of cognitive behavioral therapy, which I think is a danger to children. I think there's a place for CBT in work with particular types of adult problems, but I think it's very dangerous in work with children because it narrows the field. And we don't want the field to be narrowed, because we know in work with children, however weird, strange and odd the presenting problem is, that that is the evidence. The child's behavior is the evidence that of their experience. And they are the behavior is a testament and an absolutely accurate picture of what's going on for them. And we do not want to get rid of it through CBT. Now, I've written this book on time-limited psychotherapy entirely, it really came out of a credo curve from the child psychotherapy membership, people saying that they couldn't get jobs in child and adolescent mental health, and they were wanting to do courses in CBT. And my thought was, please, please don't do that, because psychodynamic psychotherapy is amazing, has enormous capacity, and in fact, you can do very effective time-limited work with a psychodynamic perspective. So, and then another problem about that is going back to the membership, the highly trained, competent membership, who have a sense of unease about that, whether their everyday work lacks the gold seal of approval of what is or should be at the heart of child psychotherapy. The idea of, if you do short-term work, the idea of, well, perhaps I really, really should be doing long-term work, and if only I could be doing long-term work. But one of the things that I try and point out in the book is that time-limited psychotherapy is not a watered-down version, and it's not the bargain basement bit of psychotherapy. The other thing that I think is very important is I feel there is a greater need for discussion in the membership about shared values and an ethical stance that connects advocacy with psychotherapy. I believe you can't be a child psychotherapist if you're not a child advocate, by which I don't mean you're a lawyer, but advocacy and therapy, I believe, go hand in hand. That when we have a duty of care, I think that is the absolute essence, that's the cornerstone of working with children. We have a duty of care, and that promotes advocacy. So advocacy and child psychotherapy go hand in hand. And I think, therefore, we need a broader picture of where we stand in an ethical, value-based, what our position is. So if we're going to reconfigure a psychodynamic approach for current times, one of the things that I think is vitally important, and this is easier said than done, of course, I think we've been working with a lot of old theory. A lot of it's very good, but you know, we need new theory. We need new theory for new times. And I think we've been using a lot of old theory for new and different and challenging situations. I think we have to move from what I see as an individual linear approach to one that is interactive and integrative. We have to be able to see the child living within a network of relationships, being at the center of a network of relationships. And in that sense, rather than saying child psychotherapy is about long-term work, I would like to see that people say child psychotherapy is about the primacy of the development of the psychodynamic method, the absolutely this amazing psychodynamic method predicated on the understanding of behavior, observation, on lines of continuity, that provides the connecting thread through the primacy of the developmental task, the child-parent relationship and attachment. I mean, all the things that we know about, but I think that we don't emphasize sufficiently. And in that sense, I just want to spend a moment looking at, you know, what is our work? And I would see the work of child psychotherapy, and in a sense, the work of research, focusing at the level of what I call the interconnected domains. But in other words, the profession has to attend simultaneously. I can't say, I'm only going to be doing this little bit of work with a child, and someone else is going to be, that approach has gone and must go and cannot be feasible. In other words, we have to attend simultaneously to what I see as the four different but interconnected domains in which everybody is living. These are the domains that people are actually experiencing, which is the intrapsychic, the internal experience of the child, the young person, the interpersonal, what takes place between the child, young person and their parents, the systemic, how the young person child speaks to the family. And we have to look at the environmental, the living arrangements, what surrounds the child, the school, childcare, broader social and cultural factors. Now, I just want to say something a little, just to go on if I may, to look at some of the research dilemmas. There is a tendency to think, and I can see that there's an enormous pressure at the moment to prove professional relevance through treating and researching the most disturbed children and young people who have a major background of intergenerational deprivation. And I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't do that, but I think the idea that we can do that with the kind of some of the theoretical limitations and clinical limitations we have, I think will not go very far. And this is maybe a very challenging thing to say, because I think we're trying to prove efficacy again with this single strand treatment for a population with major, major difficulties. And I've talked about cracking the problem and being cracked. What I mean by that is that a lot of people talk about, you know, how can you crack the problem of deprivation? If only we can crack it, you know, we'll find the mode, we'll find the right treatment. And my experience of working with people in a variety of different populations, many of them very deprived, intergenerationally deprived, is that one of the things one becomes observant of is that almost the only thing left to them is to make sure that we cannot succeed, that we prove ineffective with them, that we actually cannot shift them, that we cannot move them, that they withdraw from the kind of work that we want to do with them. I mean, that may be an odd thing to say, but I think we have to be very cautious and think very carefully about exactly how and how we want to operate in that area. And I've just sort of, this may be a bit of an aside, but there's a very interesting interview with Donald Meltzer that took place some years ago. It was actually published in the Journal of Child Psychotherapy. And he talked about how some psychoanalysts at various times had gone down the road of working with very disturbed psychotic individuals in the hope that it would inform our understanding about the workings of the mind. And he said, I think it's drawn us into a cul-de-sac because it tells us about how the mind can go very wrong, but it doesn't really tell us about how it goes right. And I recall in that interview that one of the things that Meltzer emphasized was the great richness and wealth and position of child psychotherapy was to stay with the developmental process. And I feel that that is absolutely vital because in that sense, we are looking at not focusing, we need to be focusing downstream, not upstream, as it were. And this also links with a lot of the research and the work that's around at the moment. And in particular, I just want to refer to some of the comments by Stuart Shanker, who was a psychologist working in Canada, who talks about dynamic systems theory. And he talks about what are the pathways that lead to mentally healthy children and the need for the developmental, he talks about a developmental pathways model as the absolute core element, and really very similar to the sort of work, the sort of point that Meltzer is making. So in other words, I think where research needs to focus is on public health. It needs to focus on what creates health in children. What are the developmental pathways? And I think that child psychotherapy, rather than waiting to be sort of bashed, as it were, and pushed into a state of irrelevance, should be acting through its enormous wealth of understanding and expertise, should be taking the initiative to start a new and different discussion, because we need a new and different paradigm. And then just finally, I just want to say something about how if we are going to be working in these very challenging and difficult times, we cannot go alone, we can't go it alone. I think first of all, we have to address who we are, what the range of the work that we do. As I've said, I feel the narrow focus on the child is not going to work anymore. I think it's led us into a kind of a cul-de-sac. I think it's vitally important for child psychotherapy to form creative alliances with the right sort of groups, not with, I know it's terribly difficult to get funding for research, and you end up having to go to bed with all sorts of people who you might not care for all that much, because they're the ones that are going to get the money. But I think we need to think a little bit more originally about what is it that we want to prove. And I'm sure there are people around and there is funding that would be able to support prevention and mental health. But I think also, because we're a small profession, I think it's very important that we work in an alliance with other groups. And that in itself can provide a kind of a model for a way of working in a cooperative, multidisciplinary kind of research endeavor. I have to say I'm very tired reading about endless children being described endlessly in pathological terms. You know, when I was doing some work on ADHD, one of the things that the ways that people talk about children with ADHD, particularly in schools, is they say, "Is he ADHD?" And you say, "Well, I never thought he was called ADHD. I always thought he was called John or Mark or something." But the idea that the child becomes the personification of the child and the essence of the child is very much about the psychopathology. And I think if we can move away from that, where we can engage children and young people as legitimate informants about their experiences rather than the carriers of pathological symptomatology, which seems again to me to be very old-fashioned. And the other area that I would like to see us exploring in research is exploring the essential interrelationship between children and parents as a marker for mental health. And then finally, what Winnicott would talk about, the enormous capacity for growth and self-healing in the child, by which I certainly don't mean that, you know, we say, oh, well, they can look after themselves, you know, or anything that's sort of a disposal. I don't mean that at all. But that I think we want to start from the position of the child, the young person, the family system, having a capacity for growth and self-healing. And rather than wanting to instruct and get rid of, I would wonder whether our research and our inquiry can move into a kind of facilitation kind of process. So I'll just stop at that point, and perhaps having already said too much.
Thank you very much, Ruth. As ever, very thoughtful and challenging. And I think you've addressed critically, actually, what is our profession? What is the nature of our profession? It seems to be an extremely important question when we're thinking about what kind of research is going to be relevant to addressing our work. But I'm not going to dwell on it at the moment. I think we'll keep to this routine. We'll hear a succession of ideas and we'll see how we go through the evening. So thank you very much, Ruth. So,
there's a reason
in that. Indeed, right, well, good, lovely. Can you all say who you are?
Yes, and I think I will sit right that I'm in audio, interrogated. That's fine for me. People can hear me all right sitting down. My name's Jocelyn Catty. I'm the research lead for the Child Psychotherapy Doctorate at Tavistock, and I'm also a senior child psychotherapist in Bexleycam's adolescent team. In terms of a broader introduction, that is sort of a background to my interest in this field, really. I originally read English and then did a PhD on early modern literature, and then had a little bit of a career change and went and worked in psychiatry, which wasn't quite as odd as it sounds, because I made that break at the point that I was just enrolling on a psychodynamic psychotherapy training. So I found myself in need of a day job and thought, I'll just see if I can convince them that research skills are transferable, sort of took a deep breath and then really enjoyed that. So I ended up staying at St. George's for 10 years, although not full time, because I've been qualified as an adult psychotherapist and was doing some of that. That research was very much about adults with severe mental illness, what you call services research, very quantitative, and I'll say a little bit about that in a minute. I then trained at the TAVI and since then been in the roles that I just performed. So, and actually I'm most of my time is taken up with the role in relation to the doctorate at the TAVI and then the clinical job in Oxley's, but I have half a day a week for a 4-year period on a big interdisciplinary project about time, actually, which is led by Bert Beck, but I'm sort of participating a very small amount of my time on it. I'm with my Tavistock hat on. So although that I'm not going to say very much about that because it's in a way not, perhaps I might later run in the running table a bit. It's on time and waiting in three areas of healthcare, including adolescent mental health care. So in a way, that's a very different form of research from the kind that I kind of cut my teeth on, which I suppose is a bit more than I'm going to talk about. So I'm not sure I am going to talk for 10 minutes because I'm looking forward to the discussion a bit, but certainly if I go on for longer than that, you shut me up. Yeah. So I really enjoyed listening to your presentation. Thank you. And I thought you talked about a lot of really important issues, as you said yourself, not just about the research agenda, but about, in a way, going forward as a profession. And I suppose I wanted to pick up on something about conversation, because I really liked your example of the teachers who say, is he ADHD, as though somehow he's been reduced to that, and rather than being a little boy called Thomas or whatever. And it made me think about the kind of conversation we then try to have with the teachers in that situation to try and enable a different sort of conversation about the child. And I think listening to your presentation, I think I was thinking about different conversations. And I think we have to have a number of different conversations with different sorts of people in a slightly different language in order to address and take forward a lot of the different points that you've been mentioning. So I think there's one kind of conversation that we might have with when we're more trying to promote what we do, that kind of conversation. I think when we're trying to evidence what we do in the particular language of evidence-based practice, it's a different sort of conversation, and possibly with different people, and about slightly different things, actually, because I think thinking of those domains that you put up, I think in a way a randomized control trial or another large bit of quantitative research isn't, and I'm looking forward to anyone contradicting me, but I would say sort of off the top of my head, isn't really about the intrapsychic, but I think it is and can be about the effectiveness of that intervention, not just for the child reduced to a single diagnostic label, but actually for that child's well-being in a more holistic way. And I think it can also be about thinking about the child in their family context, and sometimes even their social context, if you like. I think I feel particularly interested in developments in evidence-based practice and kind of quantitative methodology around how you measure, what the language for that is, a complex intervention. It's funny, if you read any of the literature on complex interventions as a psychotherapist, I think you tend to think, that's not as complex as our intervention. You think that's complex. But actually there is a whole, notwithstanding that point, I think there is a lot of work has been done on the methodology around, particularly the randomized control trials, actually, because RCTs are, on the face of it, so simple. And yet what you can take in, if you sort of expand their remit, really can embrace complexity. And they can do that by integrating qualitative work or by collecting quantitative data on the sorts of processes that we're really interested in that go on during the therapy that are the sort of heart of it before you get to the outcome bit of it, if you see what I mean. And I think those conversations are really, to be able to have those conversations are really important. I suppose I didn't say my introduction of myself, but something I'm engaged in at the minute is that I'm on the NICE guideline committee for the update of the child and adolescent depression guideline. And this is a bit of a funny time to do this roundtable because we're in the middle of it, and I think I'm not really allowed to say much about it until it's over, which is a bit tantalising. But equally, it's quite early days, so I probably haven't got that much to say about it yet. And I'm hoping that when that's over, there'll be ways of sort of sharing that experience a bit. But I think it has made me feel in a more vivid way the importance of being able to have that conversation, the importance of being able to have the conversation in the language that commissioners and policymakers and researchers and academics understand. But I think I'm interested in that, but I don't think it precludes the other sorts of conversations. I suppose I'm also really aware that to say we ought to do that kind of research because it's necessary. It just sounds really dull. It's a sort of pragmatic argument. And okay, maybe the pragmatic argument is okay if you believe that, you know, you believe the truth of that. But I don't think it is. I mean, I suppose my feeling is that it's not just about the pragmatics of it. And I'm not sure I'm necessarily going to sit here and say RCTs are tremendous fun, particularly because Nick and Elizabeth are both going to talk about RCTs have been involved in, and then they may tell you that they weren't a huge amount of fun most of the time, I don't know. Surely occasionally. I've been involved in one RCT, which was in adult mental health care, and I suppose there were good moments, but it was really hard work as well. A tremendous amount of work goes into it. But I think as well as that sort of dichotomy of pragmatism and sort of gritting our teeth and doing it because it has to be done and something a bit more lively, there's also just the fact that I think a lot more can be encompassed in them. It's actually a lot richer than the basic sort of competitive who won the race thing would lead you to believe. And I think I might leave it there actually, because I think, you know, there's lots of different things we might pick up in the discussion, but that's probably my general response.
Thank you. I like the idea of conversation. More conversation. But how do you conduct them, I guess, is the issue. Thank you very, very much indeed. Who is next amongst the three of us?
Hello, my name is, hello to everyone over there as well. My name is Elizabeth Edgington. I'm also a senior child and psychotherapist, and I'm working for Dudley Mutual Cairns.
I will do, yeah. Sure, yes. Just saying, I'm a senior child and adolescent psychotherapist now working at Dudley and Walsall Cairns. I'm also teaching on the clinical training at the Anna Freud Centre at CAPA on the research side. I was previously research and development lead at the Northern School of Child and Adolescent Psychotherapy, and in my previous existence I was an academic and worked for a number of years as a researcher and lecturer in cultural studies, working on the cross-cultural construction of national identity, and was very much a qualitative researcher. My doctorate's in cultural studies and was a mixture of sort of cultural theory and ethnography, sort of ethnography interviews and thematic analysis, so very much coming from the sort of qualitative side, really. And I suppose my interest in child psychotherapy research, you know, you can take the person out of research, but you can't really ever take research out of the person, I guess. to change a metaphor as used previously. And so when I was working at the Northern School, I think after a few months I was there, Nick came and said to me, Nick, who was obviously at the Northern School, can we do an RCT? And I remember literally having to sit down as a qualitative researcher and saying, well, I think maybe we can, but it's going to be a lot of work. And that's really how Tiger Cup got going. The research that I've been involved in as chief investigator on that feasibility study for an RCT. That's really where I'm coming from, I guess, as a researcher. And I then subsequently actually, I mean, like Joss and Nick, my first degree in English literature, but I did then, having done a master's and doctorate in cultural studies, cultural theory, I then subsequently did a master's in health sciences. Never thought I would be doing multiple regression. Somehow managed to. Don't think I ever want to again. But yes, I mean, that's probably true of all of us. We never started off as statistical types. But yes, somehow one has to at a certain point. So, I mean, I've just put together a few points now. I'm going to try and pick up on Ruth's points and also Josie's points as best I can as we go through. Why is this not wanting to cooperate with me?
think, but is it those ones? Is it the blue ones? No, it doesn't like any of it.
Ah, that's it. I thought we'd just sort of start off with a brief reminder of this hierarchy of evidence that gets used, particularly by the NICE guidelines sort of people. I'm sure people are familiar with it, but I thought it might be useful just to remind ourselves of it. And I'm sure I don't need to remind people here, that may be a little small, but I suppose the point I'm wanting to make initially is that the type of research methodology we use very much depends on our research question. And I would include, this is obviously the sort of traditional hierarchy of evidence, but I think it's really important that we include in our idea of research, research that produces theory, including psychoanalytic theory. I don't think, you know, because we are such a wide-ranging profession and we range across everything from, you know, the health sciences to film studies to, you know, psychoanalytic theory, we kind of span the arts and the sciences and the social sciences. And I think it's really important to keep that broader understanding of research, as well as this much more sort of health sciences version of, well, these are the kind of studies and this is the hierarchy of evidence for NICE. Yes, I guess the point really is that the type of research we do and the methodology we use, it seems to me, is very much dictated by, you know, what is the question we want to answer. And there are pros and cons to all of them, of course. You know, none of them gives you an answer. It gives you a type of answer to a specific kind of question, but there are always problems. And there's a quote I always love from Lewis Carroll, which is, the only accurate map is on the scale of a mile to a mile. And so anything else you do is going to be, you know, wrong, essentially. And I think, given that most child psychotherapists, I guess in this country at least, work in the NHS, it does seem to me that the question of does it work for a particular primary presenting symptom is not an unreasonable one if you're a commissioner. I think we go much wider than that. But yeah, in today's climate, certainly, you know, this child has this problem, this is a particular treatment, are they going to be better at the end of it, whatever that might mean to a parent or a commissioner or indeed to the child? And like I said, I think we go much wider than that, but that's certainly, I don't think, an unreasonable question. I do think the idea of, do we just do the child, or can we encompass the wider, you know, idea of the family and parents? Well, certainly in Tiger Cub, I mean, one of the aims of that was very much to include psychoanalytic parent work. And somebody rather flatteringly said to me a few months ago, well, you know, completely brilliant, this idea of having weekly parent work. Well, I trained at Birmingham, where weekly parent work was just what happened. And I have to say, it hadn't occurred to me to do anything different. It wasn't a stroke of genius by any means. It was simply, that's what I was used to. So the idea of once a week for child and once a week for parent, and both being psychoanalytically informed, and indeed both being provided by child psychotherapists, was simply what I was used to, I guess. So I don't think, although obviously in a randomised control trial, you know, you do have a primary outcome, and it's difficult, much more complicated to, you know, to do anything that looks both at the child outcome and the parent outcome. I mean, I think it's certainly possible to think about parents and, you know, ideally families as well, in the work that you do in a randomised control trial. And I guess, yeah, just to remind everybody of, you know, RCT methodology, you know, it does tend to focus on one particular issue, and that is the nature of the beast, I'm afraid. And, you know, and it's a process that, I guess for me, takes account of both, this is where I start to sound like Donald Rumsfeld, but, you know, both known and unknown variables, really, in the sense of variables we know and can measure, the ones we know about but can't measure or are difficult to measure, and the variables that we don't know about and therefore can't measure. And I suppose for me, in a sense, that ought really to lend itself to child psychotherapy par excellence, because of course, you know, one of the things we're always concerned with are all the other things that a child brings to psychotherapy, not just the things that we can measure. And those are at least in some way taken account of in a randomised control trial. So it enables us to take those things into account, even though it's got its own problems. And for anybody who prefers pictures, this does unfortunately make it look as if they're all behind bars. But the idea is really that, you know, those variables are going through all the way through, you know, the whole process of a randomised control trial. And I think one of the things for me, I mean, I don't want, again, you know, I don't particularly want to depend randomised controlled trials other than to say that they answer a particular kind of question that, that commissioners tend to be interested in. And I think for the survival of the profession, that can be useful. I do think they're very stimulating intellectually. I do think they enable us to include qualitative work. Indeed, these days, it's pretty much de rigueur that they have to include some qualitative work. And they certainly, where you're recording sessions, which you know has its own problems, obviously, and its own controversy, but where you're recording a lot of sessions to do the adherence and fidelity stuff around manualisation, it also gives you a wealth of material, which you can then go on and analyse. And I've just been over in the States, actually, at a conference, which is all about going beyond the average. And I took some of the sessions from child psychotherapy in Tiger Cub, and I was looking at conversation analysis of what's going on in those sessions. You know, in a very detailed way, because they just got interested in, well, you know, what's happening there at the linguistic level between that child and that parent or and the psychotherapist involved. So I think, yeah, I think RCTs can lend themselves, although they're complicated to do and they're expensive and they're not everybody's cup of tea, I think they can be used in a creative sort of way. And I guess the problem with long-term and short-term interventions and RCTs, it's not really the problem that it's an RCT is a problem. It's really that there isn't funding for really, really long-term RCTs. I mean, if there were funding for that, it would be possible to do them. It's very, very difficult to get, although I think, you know, I think impacted really well on that. RCTs are certainly not free of bias. You know, they've got their own biases, clearly, but they do think a lot about bias. And I also think it's worth saying, you know, thinking about the way in which qualitative and quantitative interact. Obviously, you know, we use the more inductive observation, we see a pattern, sensitive hypothesis, we produce theory. That's something we're very used to as child psychotherapists. Going the other way, you know, you're going from theory, formal hypothesis, observation, and confirmation or falsification of that hypothesis in an RCT. But I see those two things as very, very much being linked. You know, there's a sort of virtuous circle, if you like, and those two things are constantly interacting. So I don't think they're totally separate processes. I think they're very much related processes, and they feed into and develop from each other. I also think it's worth saying that RCT methodology can be enormously nuanced, in as much as, you know, there's lots and lots of different sorts of RCTs, obviously pragmatic and more sort of theoretical ones, but there are preference trials, all sorts of kind of different complicated things that can be done, and I'm certainly no expert in them. But it's interesting that Ruth should mention surgeons, because one of the things, talking to the methodologist, lead methodologist on Tiger Cub, who's very, very interested in what we're doing, she assures me that child psychotherapists are like surgeons, in as much as, you know, ideally what we want to do is obviously assess our patients and then say we want that one, that one, and that one. And so there are wider issues in RCT methodology that child psychotherapy lends itself to. And one of the things we're thinking of for Tiger Cub is, well, actually, can we do something with RCT methodology and develop it further and kind of come at it from a methodological angle in order to contribute to RCT methodology, as well as using RCT methodology to show something about child psychotherapy. Now, that's quite a tall order. It's quite difficult to get money to do any of those things. But yeah, it's not a static, you know, one size fits all sort of methodology. You know, as usual, once you're inside a debate, it tends to be a lot more nuanced. So I think, yeah, what gets researched does depend on funding, clearly. It is political. and I think, you know, it's vitally important, obviously, that there is clinical expertise that goes into randomised controlled trials. But I don't think it's only about clinicians or the ACP or patients determining what is research. I mean, I think we have to think about it in a much wider context of, you know, essentially what can get funded, and what do we then want to do with any funding we get. You know, as Josh said, it's sort of about speaking to different people, really. And I certainly think in the end, what goes onto a minister's desk is, from what I understand at least, is certainly, yes, does it work or doesn't it work? But also then, you know, as usual, the kind of qualitative stuff and the individual examples and the stories and the narratives, to use a better word, that enliven, you know, perhaps much duller thing about, you know, outcome sizes and effect sizes and that sort of thing. So I think all of the kinds of research that we do are vitally important, and I think they link to each other. It's not an either or. I suppose it's a more of a depressive position, if you like, in relation to research.
Thank you very much indeed.
Championing RCTs. Not reluctant, really. Right.
Well, I can briefly introduce Nick, who I'm a fan of. And if nothing else, he wrote a superb book on aneuploidy. That's probably the most interesting thing. But that's not the subject of this evening. Although aneuploid was a true scientist, in my view. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. So far, it's been really interesting hearing what's been said so far. So my name is Nick Midgley. I'm a child psychotherapist. I'm also an associate professor at UCL. I, among other things, I am the academic director of the professional doctorate in child psychotherapy, which is taught jointly between the Anna Freud Centre and the British Psychotherapy Foundation. Very pleased we've got one of our trainees here in the audience tonight. And I'm also the director of a research unit called CHAPTER, which is the Child Attachment and Psychological Therapies Research Unit. And for my sins or my pleasures, I was involved in the impact study, and I'm now working on a number of other studies more, looking at interventions with children in foster care primarily. And in fact, yeah, it's interesting, all three of us, our first degrees were in English, and it's perhaps worth, again, sort of saying, you know, I certainly came into child psychotherapy with no sort of expertise around research, no particular interest in doing research, but I was the first cohort on the Anna Freud Centre training where the child psychotherapy training became a UCL doctorate, and so as part of my training, I was introduced to research methods. I was also in a context where, as you said, Anna Freud had built into the Anna Freud Centre the idea that we should not simply be doing child psychotherapy, but we should be researching in the broader sense, understanding about children's development and psychotherapy. And obviously people like Peter Fonagy and Mary Target sort of then took on that tradition and took it in different ways, Joe Sandler. So I think I was sort of rather surprised to find myself actually finding this quite interesting. And also perhaps surprised to find that it very much fitted with my development as a child psychotherapist, that in a sense research fundamentally is just about curiosity. It's about being having questions that you want to answer and trying to find a way to answer it. And that very much sort of fitted nicely with my identity, my developing identity as a child psychotherapist as well. So I don't think, to my surprise somewhat, I found these as necessarily contradictory identities, but actually really quite complementary. And maybe if we have a chance later on in the discussion, it'd be interesting to think a little bit about training and research, which is something that I feel very passionate about. I think maybe I'll pick up just on a couple of the things that have been said previously in response to them. One, actually just going right back to the beginning of Peter mentioning this shocking document, What Works for Whom, that was published by the Evidence-Based Practice Unit in the year that I qualified. So I remember sort of it very much hit me at the time because, as you said, it sort of it went through saying, you know, for all of these different problems, there is no evidence that psychoanalytic child psychotherapy is effective. And of course, as we, you know, we were keen to point out, it wasn't saying child psychotherapy is not effective. It wasn't that there was research that it's not effective. It was simply saying there is not the research there to say whether it is effective or not. And I think, like you, I felt angry about that. I felt worried about that. But I think it was a spur to us as a profession. If I look back at it, I do think that it spurred the ACP to think, how do we respond to this? And many people in the room might remember that Ailish Kennedy was originally then commissioned by the ACP to do a review of the evidence for child psychotherapy. I joined her and we published a narrative review of the evidence first, I think, in 2007, updated it last year. And it's, I think, been really important that, as I think Elizabeth was saying, if we're in the NHS and there is a legitimate question, you know, well, does this approach actually work, that in some way we're prepared to address that question. And in the last review we did, I think there was more than 50 evaluation studies of psychology, child psychotherapy included. So there is an increasing body of research there. But one of the things I remember being very struck by when we did the first review and read all of the papers was that we kept reading papers and none of the papers referred to any of the other papers that we read. So it was almost like somebody had had an idea, well, what about psychoanalytic child psychotherapy for children with social anxiety? And they'd gone off and done a piece of outcome research about this, but knew nothing about what anyone else had done. The people who did the next thing knew nothing about what they'd done. So it was like sort of, I think I sort of compare it to like, you know, you're building a wall, but you just put a brick there, you put another brick there, you put another brick there, and you sort of think, oh, it's funny, we're not really, it doesn't look like a house much yet. And I think one of the things that happened in, and this is sort of leading to the impact study in relation to depression, was that actually for the first time, there was something that was actually building blocks. So some of you may or may not know that there are some really important studies looking back at the work that psychoanalytic child psychotherapists had done with depressed children, and began to say, looking back at this work, you know, there's something valuable in what we were doing. And that led Judith Trowell, who I think all of us owe a huge debt of gratitude to do the first randomized controlled trial of child psychotherapy as an intervention for child and adolescent depression. The Tavistock was a major part of that study. And it was that really because of that study, which was quite small scale, that the original NICE guidelines did make child psychotherapy a recommended treatment. And it was also then because NICE recommended it as a treatment that they also said, and there should be research to do further investigation of the psychoanalytic approach. So it was only because of what Judith Trowell did that we had NICE, and it was because of what NICE did that we had the impact study. And I think, you know, thanks to the impact study, someone as surprising as Ian Goodyear publishes papers in which he says psychoanalytic child psychotherapy should be offered alongside CBT and other approaches as an intervention for depression in children and adolescents. This is a professor of psychiatry with absolutely no interest in psychoanalytic approaches making public statements of this kind. And it does matter. I mean, we don't know what the outcome of this new NICE review will be, but we hope that the impact study will help to make the case for why child psychotherapy should be included there. There is a big debate going on in the States at the moment about the APA, the American Psychological Association, making guidelines on depression, and probably the impact study may be the difference between them including psychoanalytic work in those guidelines or not. So in terms of some of those questions about needing to speak to different audiences, clearly this is a kind of language we need which does speak to some audiences. We probably want to also try and change the parameters of those discussions as well, and there is interesting debates about RCT methodology. But I think we do need to engage in those conversations and try to change the conversations. I will say one more thing, if I may, before I stop, and just to somebody raised the question, since I did work on the Impact RCT, was it fun? I'll tell you what I would say, it has been interesting. Mm-hmm. It has been really interesting for all kinds of reasons. But one of the things is, I think, and this goes back to something that you were saying, Ruth, is, you know, research shouldn't lead the agenda. Which we should decide what are the important questions that we have, and we should think, how can research help us to answer those questions? And if we decide collectively or for different people, what actually really matters is public health and how a psychoanalytic approach can contribute something to promoting public health, research, we should work out how could research help us with that. I think at that moment with the impact study, the question was, can psychoanalytic therapy help us in the treatment of adolescent depression? And in fact, fitting with what you say, and not simply long-term work, but when it's relatively brief. So that was the question that the profession, I think, put. And one thing that was really interesting was trying, which research constantly makes you have to specify, well, what do you mean by that? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that, you know, the Ian Goodyears of this world came to us and said, what do you mean by time-limited, short-term psychoanalytic psychotherapy. Well, what do you actually mean by that? And the result of that was the book that was published by Karnak last year, The Short-Term Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy for Depressed Adolescents, which I would say, you know, like Ruth's book, is an attempt to describe what we do, including what's the conceptual framework for that, what are the parameters, what are the principles we work on. And I was really pleased, there was a review of the STPP manual in the latest Journal of Child Psychotherapy, and the reviewer said, I picked this book up in dread, thinking, oh my God, a manual to describe psychotherapy. I mean, manual's a horrible word, I completely share that. But what she said in the review, she came away thinking, this was actually a really interesting chance to reflect on what we mean by psychoanalytic work in a time-limited way with a particular population. So that in itself, having to specify what we meant, I think was a really interesting process. I was involved in this fidelity work, which meant actually then listening to sessions and being able to say, can we say whether what the therapist was doing here, we would consider it psychoanalytic psychotherapy? That was a really interesting process. And can we consider it psychoanalytic psychotherapy? And also, can we say that it's different from CBT? And what makes it different from CBT? We've just published a paper this year on techniques based on this impact data, where we've found that actually there were certain techniques that CBT therapists and psychoanalytic child psychotherapists were both using. But there were clearly some techniques the child psychotherapists were using and some that CBT, which weren't shared. That was interesting for me. I've got a PhD student who's working on dropout in child psychotherapy in the impact study. And she's produced really interesting understandings about what might predict whether a young person drops out. But also, in fact, it's not even obvious that dropping out led to poorer outcomes. There are some young people who dropped out of therapy and had as good outcomes, and in some cases better, than those who stayed in therapy. Now, on, you know, my first thought was, don't tell anyone that. But then she looked into it, and actually it was really interesting. It was because there were some people who dropped out of therapy because they really felt, I've got what I needed from this. My therapist thinks I should keep coming, but actually I've got what I needed. And we look at their outcomes, they're really good. There were other young people who dropped out of therapy thinking, I don't like my therapist, I don't like the way we're working, this isn't helping for me. Their outcomes were quite poor. We then went to look and see what was going on in the sessions. And she picked up that these young people, from the second or third session, they were having kind of what she called alliance ruptures with their therapist. So were the ones who had good outcomes. But the ones who went on to drop out with poor outcomes had alliance ruptures which weren't being picked up and addressed by the therapist. That's interesting to me. You know, I could give you another 10 examples of doctorate students working on impact study. You know, I think there are a lot of interesting questions, and there's a lot of different methodologies that we might want to use in order to address those different questions. But I do think we need a kind of research literacy in order to do that. And that's where, for me, training is so important. I wouldn't be even sitting here if my training hadn't introduced me to a set of ideas which I came with no particular interest in knowing about. And I do feel quite passionately that if we can provide that to our trainees and the future members of the ACP, it gives us more options, a wider repertoire to find interesting things to do.
Well, I like your passion. That's good. Thank you. Right. Well, thank you, you four people. Why don't you cluster a bit closer to each other and have a conversation with each other so that we can watch and learn from. See what you've made of what you've been saying to each other, and then we'll bring in everybody, including there. So who would like to kick off?
I'll kick off. I'm fascinated by the people talking about research, and it sounded fantastic, really very interesting. I'm still concerned that we are neglecting, I think, two things. I feel that there is an enormous problem that can't just be described in terms of individual research. I think two things. That we're looking at individual pathologizing of children, which worries me right across the board. I think it's as though
you can't do research without looking at a problem that you want to solve. And I feel concerned about the way in which the research itself describes children, describes young people. I'm concerned about the enormous groundswell of psychopathology, which becomes the second language of research. It's almost as though that's the only vehicle through which research can be conducted. And I remain very concerned about the fact that there is a public health problem around child and family mental health. And I want to see, I don't think this is just the job of researchers. I don't think it's just your job. My focus is still very much about the association as a whole being able to take a stand and being able to find a way of thinking differently about what is actually going on with children, parents and families, and what the role of the association can be, and then what the role of the research should be. I mean, I accept everything that you've said. I think it's beautifully put, but I feel that it's like a seam. It feels like a thin seam in which where I feel, I suppose I have to say, it's not enough. I feel there is a huge problem that we have to address, and that we have to find a different language. I don't know that research is the only way to do it, but I feel that that concerns me. I don't want to leave that off the agenda for the discussion.
What do you think?
Well, I suppose I was just thinking that research isn't the only way to do it. We've been picking up those bits of the conversation again, if you like. But I think, you know, I think there are different arguments that need to be made, and they're not. It goes back to what Elizabeth was saying about what the question. Well, I'm Nick as well, about what the question is that one's asking. And I think the three of us have been very much picking up on the sorts of questions that might be best answered by formal research methods, but there are others, and those are important. And perhaps what you're highlighting is that some of those are more appropriate to be picked up by a professional body like the ACP in a different sort of a way.
I think that's right. I don't think that the three of you can stand for dealing with that. What I think is the vastness of that problem. I think you can only deal with what it is that. The particular questions that you find yourself wanting to answer or becoming involved in. I'm not suggesting for a moment that you're responsible in some way, but I think that the research findings have been very interesting, and throw light on the need for the association to take charge in some way. I mean, and to really think about what the future holds. And where the association wants to be, and what is its primary task, and who should be within that primary task, as it were.
And you see any kind of research activity that could bolster what you want to say to the public health agenda? I mean, what do we need to do to substantiate what we want to say?
The idea of your idea of conversation. I'd like the idea of a conversation with children and young people and parents about who they are and what they need and where they see themselves. I can't formulate a question around that, but I feel that we're somehow dismissing people. We're coming from above, as it were, with various ideas about how people should be and think and so on. And I feel we need a completely different dialogue.
I think I would agree with you. I mean, I can see where you're coming from on that. And I suppose one of the things that has informed my thinking as a researcher is very much being a clinician. But still being a clinician within an NHS, which, does have an idea, as you say, the more medicalized version of things, which is still a very narrow and limited understanding of what the problem is. But I suppose I'm then thinking about some of the work that Nick's done as part of the impact trial.
while, and the films, you know, that have come out of that, which again are, you know, are within the research agenda and you know, on a specific sort of topic, but the way in which research, I think that needs to come from clinical issues and from families and children and in that sort of sense, rather than being completely divorced and, you know, and just in the university. I don't think that really works terribly well on the whole. But I still think that research can be used in a much wider sense, you know, if you're creative about it. And, you know, where it is well funded and it is a way, you know, it is difficult to get. But very often you can tuck things in. Of course, you shouldn't have to just tuck things in. You know, there should be money available for those much wider projects. Yes. Unfortunately, on the whole, that is pretty surely difficult to get. So it is a question of then being creative in the sorts of things that you try and do, almost under the radar, unfortunately. But I very much agree with you that it's really important to have those things there. And equally, even within the narrow remit of, you know, NICE and health economics, you know, I think there are ways of broadening out gradually. You know, a lot of, I mean, people, without getting too technical, people may be familiar with, you know, the health economics that NICE uses and the EQ5D, and it uses very specific questions as to what it is interested in. You know, has this been value for money in a very particular kind of way? Well, there are gradually moves to broaden that out to something a bit more suitable for mental health, I'm sure you know. But I think it is a very sort of gradual game of, you know, a sort of learning to speak that language and then subverting it to a degree, is how I see it.
I agree with that. You see, I wonder whether we may need to take a slightly different route, and I'm very mindful that I don't live here anymore, so I may be totally speaking out of turn. But I wonder whether the children can wait and the parents can wait for the niceties of NICE. You know, whether in fact they can't. And whether we can't just be subverting, whether we have to be much more bold and form alliances with other organisations or with, you know, I'm always amazed at the kind of publicity that people get for all sorts of causes and positions. Amazing, you know, one in the government's supporting something of all the, you know, media are supporting something, but it's so difficult to get anything going for child and family mental health. It always seems to be right at the bottom of the agenda. How can we get it out of, into something more public, into something more mainstream, into being really very, somehow more, creating a greater sense of urgency about the situation? Because I think it is a very urgent position. I think we're at a tipping point, really. And the same applies in Australia. I mean, it's not all sun and sea in Australia either. You know, the child and adolescent mental health services have been absolutely, they're in a situation where if you're, unless you're a young person or a child who's killed someone or you're dead, you're not going to be able to get a place.
I have to say, you know, child mental health is much, much higher on the public agenda than it's ever been, frankly. And I think that's due to a number of forces, really. There are a number of organisations that are very active in this. Young Minds is one. Place to Be is very active. I think what Nick has been really revving up from the association, really, the way he's right, get in touch. And I think it is, and you hear government ministers talking about child mental health. I remember when I began Young Minds, you say child mental health, people think you were abusing children, you're maligning saying children are crazy. Now it's a much more accepted term, but it hasn't yet translated into real substantial political investments. It's just not made that transition yet. But you can't really, I mean, almost every week there's a big story now about not enough beds, about self-harming. I mean, there are stories by the week, and child mental health is always up there. But there's a much further way to go. So it seems to me that your agenda is much broader than whether or not child psychoanalytic therapy is effective. It's much a broader issue that you're raising. Yes. And, but that comes out of your very thoughtful attempt to get at the nature of what child psychotherapy is these days. Mm. And you're basically saying we're not little precious people in a little room at the edge of the corridor who sees one or two or three children long term. We are a much broader based profession now, working multidisciplinary, doing all sorts of things. and actually talking to children in ways which probably are not all that dissimilar to a cognitive behavioural therapist. I mean, I do find that discovery, I agree, that's very interesting. So I think what you're talking about is much larger than whether or not we're effective or not. But the burning question for us is, how do we have this wonderful conversation with commissioners or with who's the wonderful Minister of Health that we've got now? What's his name?
Matt Hancock.
How about, would you like to conceive of a conversation with Matt Hancock? Do you know who he is? Do you know who is Matt Hancock? How do we have conversations with commissioners? Can we find another way of engaging them with the importance of their work?
Well, I'm not going to exactly answer that, but it is making me think, and I apologise if I sound a bit gloom and doom here, but it's not just, I think, that research can't answer all these things, can't answer all the particular questions, but I think even when research can answer some questions, that doesn't mean that policymakers necessarily want to listen to that. Mm-hmm. I worked for 10 years in adult psychiatry, and I watched time after time studies that have taken 2 or 3 years, even 5 years to complete, completing, publishing. They changed the policy halfway through that period of time because they weren't interested anymore. You can't just think, we'll do this study, we'll demonstrate something, and then policy will fall into our lap.
That's right.
And I think it is quite helpful to, which your last comment also reminded me of, to, I mean, I suppose what I'm saying is, I don't think it's evidence-based practice that's really our enemy. I think a much more important enemy is austerity and probably Brexit. And the real threats to the profession, as indeed our multidisciplinary colleagues' professions, lie there rather than in some of these sort of very technical questions about what we can demonstrate. Mm. They might lie there if people would listen, but we can't guarantee that they'll listen.
And I think that's what I was meaning when I was saying, what goes across the minister's desk.
Yes.
The research is sort of probably down there, if anywhere at all. It's much, I think the stories alongside and all sorts of other, much more. Almost like advertising type sort of approaches are in there as well, I think. But I think the other thing that's worth bearing in mind is that also in the minds of CAMS managers, in my experience, having spent the last year doing full-time CAMS, NICE guidelines, certainly at the local level, I'm not sure they're much notice is taken on from anyway, really. People tend to do what people know works, and I put "know" in inverted commas. It's seldom evidence-based. I mean, I think further up trust, there's a lot of lip service paid to evidence-based, but I don't actually think most of what's going on in CAMS is evidence-based.
So
really.
Are we barking up the wrong tree, worrying about the evidence, do you think?
I think we have to, if we don't do it, then I think that question will always be asked, well, does it work? Because it's an easy political target.
Yeah.
So I think it's got to be there for that reason, but I don't think it's what persuades people necessarily, or certainly not, not the kind of ministers and perhaps other people we might want to persuade.
Mm.
I think there's much more going on than just the evidence. But I think if you don't have it, you're always open to easy criticism.
Yeah.
I'd like to make a comment listening to what
they're sitting open up.
They're more like an observer than someone who works in charge. It strikes me that, particularly when automatically take for granted that politicians and policy makers have been getting clarity about the meaning is very important as a policy side. I have a sense that there are two meanings. Very clear, two cemented. One is evidence and research related to existing practice, focus on outcomes, how does it work? And then there is a hope that there is a legitimate interest in data. But then there is another level of meaning of evidence. How evidence is child psychotherapy and non psychotherapy for society within in the larger context. Those two contexts do not necessarily immediately merge. they may not be a whole strict logic or evidence in one context that goes through into the other. The other context may need a different type of inquiry altogether in terms of policy making, decision making. The big picture, you cannot as a researcher, and have all the time the big picture in mind. It's almost impossible. To break it down and talk to the elements of the practical of the relevant. But these two semantics are not necessarily operating in the same field, in the same mental field when it comes to evidence. So then it makes sense. You're just listening to how you science. One problem is not necessarily one problem solved in one context may not necessarily solve the problem.
And that's where I think what I was saying about research being a very wide range of things, you know, across multiple disciplines. And you know, the work of Michael Ruskin, for example, being very important, and you know, it going across the social sciences as well as the health sciences. The arts, and you know, that in a sense is one of the strengths of child psychotherapy or psychoanalytic psychotherapy more broadly, is that we do lend ourselves to that range. Because as you say, you know, they're different ontological sort of planes, if you like.
One of the challenges, how do you link to it too? I think that you can get some kind of outcome of work of the literature. And as making policy makers sensitive to take that into account and decision in the broader practice of reading. But that's not the same thing.
Can I just ask if people speaking from the audience, that we're trying to speak up a little bit because we're trying to capture it on the microphone. Somebody couldn't get through. Yeah, Leanne's going to in a minute.
They're able to speak to us now?
Yeah.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Would you like to make a comment or a question? What you've heard so far?
It's been fascinating. I think there's first of all, I think the wake-up call that we got about there not being any evidence base for what works for whom was actually really useful. And all the impact study and the different research has given us a place. And as somebody who's sort of representing the profession, I can get a seat at the table because I've got that. Without that type of information, nobody's going to speak to me. They're just going to wait until I retire and then get rid of the profession. So it keeps us at the table. But I think this idea that there's actually a public health issue here is absolutely central. And I always think with child psychotherapy, we didn't design it to be a treatment for depression or to be a treatment for anxiety. It's the psychoanalytic method in practice with children and families, and it happens to be really healthy and beneficial for people. And I think if we just see it as a treatment, we're missing its unique quality, because it's not just a treatment. In the way that CBT is a treatment, child psychotherapy is a curiosity. And there's something different there. But the public health thing is absolutely right. I don't think any of the evidence-based interventions are actually producing a positive impact on the public health. And I think our perspective can contribute to that in a really interesting way. I'm frustrated. Like, I think the RCTs are really good and essential, but I'm also frustrated that as a profession, we don't gather the same information about our patients. We don't have a uniform way of saying, here's how we consider this case to be successful. Here's the audit of my cases. And actually, if we put all these together, we could have an audit of hundreds of people's cases that would be really convincing. And I think the association, if we could get together and actually just set some standards that we all work to and report on, we could gather some information very, very quickly together, which would also be very convincing. Or not, depending on the quality of what we come up with. But I do think that if we can get the association to set the agenda and to be coherent in that way, it would be very helpful indeed.
Did you hear that?
Yes.
You did hear it? Good. Okay. Thank you for that. Thank you very much. Any comment? Yeah.
I suppose just to pick up on the last part, because I do think we focused on the title of this was effective, but there's different research for different contexts. And one of the things I think is just what the ACP, for example, could potentially take a lead on is what's called a practice research network, which is exactly what Andrew was just describing there, which is a way of bringing together practitioners who are working in very different contexts. Many of us work in private practice, for example, touring on a private practice, but coming up together with some collective framework for in each of our own practices, what would we like to be, either what questions do we have, or how would we like to, do we want to have a shared way of deciding the things that matter that we think we should all be collecting? And practice research networks is one way of both getting people in very diverse locations involved in something. But as you say, you know, building up quite quickly, quite a large set of information about what we do and how it's, if one wants to, how it's being effective, which I think is, you know, is the kind of thing that at the profession level we might consider. It's a very different type of research to, let's say, public health research. I mean, I suppose the slight struggle I'm having about discussion about public health is I'm not quite sure in what way research is preventing that from happening. But I think if as a profession we decided what our focus should be is on public health and not framing things in psychopathological terms, we can do that. And research could then play a role in helping us learn about that.
I don't think research is stopping us, but I think research should also be looking at how we create healthy children and families. You know, what contributes to health. I think one of the things, you know, as one gets a bit older in life, is that what one reads, you know, interminably about what causes a problem, you know, the interminable trauma, the impact of trauma. I think there's an enormous amount of research and evidence and literature on what goes wrong. But I think there's a wealth, there's a whole world of, and you referred to it a little bit, about some young people in the study who went away after a couple of sessions. And I think one becomes really quite fascinated with how is it that there are a lot of people walking around the world, in a sense, who may have had very difficult life histories and who somehow manage. And I think we need a lot more information. How does that work? Well, we need a lot more information about health and a lot more information about how do people manage vicissitudes of trauma and difficulties. We have a huge amount of information about how people don't manage it. And I think it would be fantastic for child psychotherapists to move into that area. We'd really like to know what are the key factors. And again, taking a much more developmental perspective, I think is very critical. I just want to say something else, which I feel in a way, I perhaps have to repeat this, but I do hear over and over again, which when people talk about the work that they do, I remain very concerned that child psychotherapists, a lot of them still see their work as very much just focused on working with the child, and that there is not enough work with parents. And I think I honestly don't feel we can get to first base in that position. I think there has got to be an agreement in the association about what the profession includes, about who the core people are who we are working with. And I believe absolutely that it is essential that the child and adolescent and parents have to be worked with together. I just feel to separate them out. I feel it's just working with your hands tied behind your back, frankly. And I remain very concerned about that as a foundational position in the association. And I hear it, I hear a lot of lack of clarity about it. And I keep coming back to that because I feel unless that is worked out, I don't know how the research questions themselves then start up for what I see as a false position. That was one of the things that I tried to talk about in the
in the bulletin.
Can I pick up on that point and that point, if I may? I mean, I think I would very much agree that it's what you're saying to say. And I suppose, again, it comes back to that point of training. But I think one of the things that has shifted over the last few years is I think most trainees now are learning to do clinical audits. And that seems to me a very useful thing. That we can build on, and that the association might then be able to take the lead on in terms of what can be done at a national scale. And there are very many, you know, be really, really helpful, whether it's in terms of thinking in terms of clinical audits or thinking in terms of research, for the ACP to know, you know, exactly who we've got where in which trust and who the lead child psychotherapist is for that trust, so that we've got that sort of network capacity. I think that'll be really, really important. I guess one of the things we did on the research committee was to introduce that much more health sciences-based agenda, which not everybody agrees with, and I don't think it's the be-all and end-all, but that has actually formed the trainings much more now. It does mean that we've got a network of trainees and gradually more qualified people who can, you know, really run with some of those skills. I mean, I think, coming back to the public health agenda, again, I think there's real scope for child psychotherapy. I mean, particularly now post Family Nurse Partnership, people will be aware that Family Nurse Partnership was brought home from the States. Big RCT was done in this country with Kate Pickett and all the Born in Bradford stuff, and that government got a lot of study there. So I think the agenda is very different now post that. But I still think it comes back to those conversations. You know, it concerns me that we're not having more conversations with those kinds of people, because I think actually they're quite open to having conversations with us, in my experience. But it's, you know, it's time and it's resources and it's, as someone who over the last year has often been up at 5:30 trying to do research, you know, before I go into a day camp, you know, how do you fit that in on top of everything else? And that's a very real issue. You know, I am having conversations with people up in York about those sorts of things, but it's, you know, when you do it.
Well, perhaps it shouldn't just be you. I think that what this is really saying, I mean, I'd also quite like to hear what people feel, because I don't think that
I think we do need to ask you for your comments and questions. We're getting, time is running out already. I wonder whether anybody would like to.
Can I say something about these conversations and about language? Because it seems to me that there's something about research which for your average layperson is more of an intellectual thing with a language, which is actually very difficult for most people to make any use of. Whereas I think if that research is translated into the language of emotions and is talking about despair and loneliness and unhappiness and terror, you know, if there's something about the combination, about trying to, through the ACP, to be able to talk in a really authoritative way about these things in that kind of language of emotion, as opposed to the language of research, but making it clear that it is based on solid research, that seems to me very important. And I think that the developments in research within the profession over the last 20 years or so are so important, because there's a confidence within the profession now that you can hold your own. You know, I'm so glad that our trainees and newly qualified people coming through with the knowledge that I don't have, that they can actually say to other people, they can look at other people's research and sensibly discuss it and say, but actually you've not taken account of this and this, you know, this doesn't make sense, and RTC are all very good, but you know, our work is so much more complex than that. And that's why talking about emotions matters. I think one of the most powerful pieces of evidence that has somehow been circulating much more now is that one of the highest causes of death in adolescence is suicide. It's not illness, it's not car accidents, it's not crazy sports, it's suicide. And I think that is a shocking statistic. So talking about unhappiness and despair and desperate and loneliness and sadness linked to our research base is where we really know what we're talking about, because of our experience I think we gain credibility enormously because of the research that's been going on, and we can lead an agenda there. I think we should be leading an agenda there towards more qualitative research, so that having got the respect of other professions in the way that I don't think we had, for good reason, because we were not doing the research that needed to happen. But having gained that, now is the opportunity to say, but we have to take this further and to pull towards quality research, to pull towards a situation where we actually get patients such as those who are prepared to talk, to actually say, I did this for this time, it was really good. Simple. I'm thinking TripAdvisor, I know it's not TripAdvisor, but something where along those lines is powerful stuff in the media and elsewhere. We need to do that.
Yeah. Anybody else like to say? Yes, yeah, Charlotte.
Say a couple of things. My name's Charlotte, or Jarvis Anderson. I've been very much involved clinically in the last 5 years, but I have done quite a lot of my own research, and audit rings very good bell for me. That's how my research started off. I did audit with the Tavistock Adolescent Department, what was happening to the parents who were referring themselves, and it was completely disorganized. No coherence about how parents were ending up in the department, and that kick started me 30 years really of research in parenting. So, with my confirm that side of our work, and I support your whole agenda. I think what you say, I think is because very should be very pay great attention to what you're saying. I feel you're saying something tremendously important. I think it's a slightly different debate to the research. I think we've got too much of an agenda. I just wanted to say a couple of things about parenting. I mean, one thing I wanted to say is parents I focused on were parents of teenagers who wouldn't come for therapy. Right. So we can't always work. We don't necessarily engage. And it was good that some of those teenagers that dropped out actually got what they needed. Yeah, teenagers can respond very quickly to short interventions. Lots of evidence, Jeffrey Bullish, when it's found a lot of evidence about that. But there are lots of youngsters who don't engage, and parents who are left to carry the can. And I think we do not yet have a kind of an identity association. I hold myself part responsible because I think I did some work on it and I've stepped away. But I have been involved in developing intervention, which I don't think I would call psychoanalytical. It's a short-term, very focused intervention, but it was very deeply rooted in evidence. I'm looking at what the problem was, trying to develop something. I just wanted to say that. And then the other two things I wanted to say, just about the general thing about kind of how we present ourselves as professionals. I was thinking about Triple P, which came from Australia, which came to this country, and was a great tidal wave. Mm-hmm. Practitioners were trained in Triple P, and if you looked at what their own place was when they came, it wasn't that good. I have to tell you, it really wasn't that great.
I mean, it was a terrible import export.
Well, it was. Well, it was terrible. I think it did some good work. I think it did. I don't like to knock it completely, but. I think it overstretched itself. I think it got oversold. I don't think it could stay coherent. And I don't think probably that was because I don't think the practitioners were that well enough trained,
really,
to be honest with you. So, but that's an example of how if you've got the right flags, got the right, you can actually really explode into being. And the other one I'm thinking about is mindfulness. Because mindfulness, there is some evidence, there are tons of clinical psychologists involved doing research and PhDs and all of this, so there's an evidence base being built up. But I heard yesterday about
clearly autistic children and adolescents and the adolescents themselves, and that it's all about sort of trying to get them to stop and to stand and think about their feet and all things which, like an amateur, we might not think was right. And the evidence on it was really good. Now, mindfulness is another one that's infiltrating into the zeitgeist, and I don't know how it's getting commissioned if it's not in the right guidelines. I don't understand this process. But there are ways that good interventions can attract people, can attract people who need help. I mean, ultimately, you know, that's what we need to have in mind, is how do we engage people with help? Okay. I think association.
We're running out of time. Is there one more comment or question somebody in the audience would like to ask? Yes.
I think this is kind of along the lines of something Monica was. I think the real power of the second one is to provide something to really ordinary language. You can use very easy words.
Hmm.
In a session with the child, in a session with the parent, and the child together, in a session with two parents, and address something that's quite powerful, who was unknown somewhere, has been avoided for a very long time. So I think I have struggled to somehow marry the research, and because I've always liked that sort of sense of immediate, something you can address. And I kind of disagree, I think, but actually, I very much feel that I am part of the team that includes as a psychotherapist, but as someone who has something to contribute and say to all kinds of different professionals. And again, through these kind of language, addressing the basic, we would consider basic, but often important sort of interaction with children going through. And I think that's the task in a way as well, to sort of try and stay and sort of what. And I think we do, for example, with parent child, like maybe 12 sessions. And always you can start with the parent and child, and leave the parent and talk to the child, come back and try and understand what, especially if it's a separation or loss, and it's a new family. I think the power of bringing these people together is much more. So I agree with you, but I also disagree, because I think it's happening already. All the family, and I feel much more free to do this qualified second visit. But I wasn't trained because I was very. So there are pressures, I'm sure, for some people, the training to think about as well. But I think that there's a lot to be done for the research, but I think you shouldn't be perhaps trying to be scientific and out to talk to the other disciplines by trying to, but finding the real sort of ways of communicating what we actually do with someone. But
okay.
Exact.
Thank you. Right. I'm going to have to close the meeting because 8:30 is a precious time. I don't quite know what we're going to do with this evening. I don't know what's been accomplished this evening. The title was Where Next for Research into the Evidence of the Effectiveness in Psychoanalytic Child Psychotherapy. And I guess in a lot of people's minds there was us versus CBT or other therapies. I think Ruth broadened the agenda enormously and looked very critically and actually what is a child psychoanalytic, child psychotherapist this day, what he or she should be, given the enormity and the complexity of the family, the environment, the system in which people live. And I think in broadening it out, we then enter into an issue about public health and how do we influence public health, and how do we actually move our minds away from pathology, which we are very often asked to do, whether we use that word or not, to what I think is called salutogenic neurology. And I do know that in the education world, there's a very strong move towards looking at what actually makes what works, and a big, big interest in resilience these days. How is it that people prosper against the odds? So there is there is a lot going on. So I think we've had a very broad based discussion, really, and some really interesting and passionate and knowledgeable contributions really from Nick, Elizabeth and Jocelyn about what goes on in research and the discipline of research, which I'm afraid I have no knowledge of at all. That's before my time that this all happened. So I think we're going to have to think what we're going to do this evening, whether we're going to draw from the discussion that we've had and think about whether we take on another event or what we do. But I think all the time, how can we promote our work? How can we develop it? How can we make it more relevant to the public? How can we make it more persuasive to commissioners that we are really worth employing? And I think those questions still are very much alive. And we will think further about it, Nick, will we not?
Yes.
We will.
We will.
Okay. Well, listen, thank you all very much, really, for coming out to this kind of gloomy part of the day, sitting around here talking about something which actually is fascinating, but it's hard. So thank you for coming here, and thank you all, four of you.